trailed off, and then vomited copiously between his feet. Ironhulks crackled in alarm, and Lannery climbed from her seat and surveyed the mess. The ship's support systems sprang into overdrive, but the air filters could not work fast enough to swallow the stink.
Oh,
Lannery said. Tree was panting and wiping his mouth, sweating, shivering.
Sorry.
Nox, she said. We breathed too much of its atmosphere.
You?
I feel fine. Do I? She thought. She assessed herself and found nothing of concern, save her mixed emotions about Dale. But there were still 2 days traveling until they reached Sunspot. If Tree sickened, there was nothing she could do but practice the medical skills she had learned at Maharakesh. And if he died, there was the airlock. But she could not fall ill. She only hoped that Tree's sickness was a result of Nox's poisonous atmosphere, not something more insidious he might have caught. If at any point he appeared contagious, she might have to take action. She looked away from Tree for a moment at the cockpit screens. The signal from Dale's ship was still on the tracker, still 8 million kilometers ahead of them. She could not take any risks. But she knew she could never throw Tree from the airlock alive. Use my cot to rest, she said. I'll clean it up. Drink plenty of water. Tree did not argue. He pushed past her, lay on her cot, and slept almost instantly. Lannery looked down at the vomit spread across the cockpit floor. I wish you had arms, she said to Ironhulks. The droid grated something that sounded like a chuckle. Over the next 2 days, Tree did not grow any worse, but neither did he improve. He ate small amounts of food, but more often than not brought it back up. He drank plenty of water. Shivering and sweating in Lannery's cot, his sleep was troubled, and his dream mumblings were incoherent and disturbing. Lannery spent most of the time in her cockpit seat, keeping track of Dale's ship and catching brief, uncomfortable naps. Her dreams were vague and unpleasant. She woke more than once with the idea that something was flapping silently about her head, slashing with barbed tendrils and seeking her blood. And she had one dream where she watched from outside the system as Tython itself, and Tythos, and then every planet and moon that orbited it, was swallowed to nothing. Billions of lives and loves and dreams wiped out almost in the blink of an eye. As they approached Sunspot at last, she accessed the ship's computers to remind herself about the damned place. She knew that environmentally it was even more unwelcoming and harsh than Nox. Her research reminded her how much so. Sunspot was the first planet of the system. Its orbit sometimes took it as close as 48 million kilometers from Tythos. It was considered a solid planet, yet much of its surface was in constant turmoil, volcanoes and quakes changing its landscape almost from day to day. Its more settled areas were mainly at the poles, and it was here that the scattered mining communities were located. It was perhaps the harshest inhabited environment in the Tython system, yet the rewards for the miners were huge. Most only lasted 1 or 2 seasons before leaving the planet and vowing never to return. Around 10% of those who went to Sunspot seeking their fortunes died there. It was a hungry planet, and though it gave, it also took as much as it could. It was also a curiosity in the system, because it orbited counter to every other planet. There were those who speculated that it was a rogue planetoid, tumbled into Tythos's gravity well in the distant past. This raised some startling ramifications, and 3,000 years ago there had been a series of exploratory missions visiting the planet, searching for any signs of previous habitation. But none had ever been found. No trace of civilizations, no ruins, no evidence that any sort of life had ever flourished there. Sunspot was a dead planet that breathed the white-hot breath of molten rock, and the rest of the system regarded it merely as a resource. Even approaching Sunspot's dark side, the violence of its surface was obvious. It radiated a steady glow from a fine network of volcano ranges and magma lakes and rivers, and the shadows of noxious gas clouds the size of a continent filtered the light, turning it an almost attractive pinkish hue. Southern Pole, Lannery said. Dale's ship had slowed considerably and was entering the atmosphere, swinging around to approach Sunspot's south pole from the planet's dark side. She had already calculated a similar path, and the Peacemaker's computer was taking them in. There was a possibility that Lannery could even close the gap between them and shoot Dale down before he landed. Her customized laser cannons were powerful and accurate, and the Peacemaker carried 4 drone missiles that were effective at 800,000 kilometers. But if she missed, he would be alerted to her presence. Yes, that was why she didn't open fire. The advantage of surprise. She convinced herself of this as she made ready to take to the surface, and Tree watched her every move.
"I wish I could come with you,"
he said for the 10th time.
"No, you don't,"
Lannery said.
"True. I don't. You take me to the nicest places,"
says the Twi'lek who took me to the pits. Tree watched as Lannery prepared herself. She changed her clothing, and lacking her lost sword, she plucked a spare sword from a cabinet beneath her cot. It was the weapon she had trained with before Master Tem Madog had forged her own. She hefted it in her hands, swung it several times, and remembered its weight. It was a surprising comfort.
"It becomes you,"
Tree said.
"It'll have to do."
She sheathed the sword, the screech lizard sheath remained at her hip, and knelt by the cot again. She removed 2 blasters from the cabinet and slipped them into her belt. Tree watched, eyebrows raised. Lannery only shrugged. A chime from the cockpit signaled that their descent had begun. She felt the familiar shifting in her stomach as they entered the atmosphere and the Peacemaker's grav units faded out, and she watched Tree, wondering if he'd vomit again. But he held himself together. She indicated that he should strap himself in, then sat next to him on the cot.
"You don't want to land the ship yourself?"
he asked. "I will, once we're close to the surface. But Tree," she squeezed his shoulder, "I'm leaving you in my Peacemaker. My ship. This is my home, and I'm trusting you to treat it well."
"I'll guard it,"
he said. "Iron Hulks can do that, and the ship has its own defenses. Just don't touch anything. Anything."
"Trust me,"
he said, smiling. His eyes were watery and weak, his skin pale, Leku limp. "I have to," she said. The Peacemaker rocked and kicked as it sliced down into Sunspot's violent atmosphere. Lights glowed, warnings chimed from the control panels, and the screens darkened as heat burned across the hull. Lannery climbed into her flight seat, taking control of the ship. She checked the scanner, uploaded a terrain map onto another screen, and accessed the ship's computer to download as much information as she could find about the area. Dale and his stargazers had landed at a small mining outpost called Randan's Folly. According to her records, the mine worked a deep source of plutonium and marionium, both elements used to power ships' drives, and that could also be weaponized. The mine had been in existence for almost 100 years, and there seemed to be nothing spectacular about it that set it aside from any other Sunspot business concern. A tragedy 30 years ago in which 100 miners lost their lives, a strike 18 years ago that led to violent riots, and an eventual buyout by the workforce and their families off-planet. Shipping and trade deals with parties on at least 3 planets, including Tython. If Randan's Folly was a source of dark matter, nothing had ever been noticed, and no one knew. No one but Dale. Lannery experienced a brief, chilling fear that her brother had found the tracking device she'd planted on him and placed it on another ship. She'd followed for 3 days, and all the while, he had been heading for Tython. Perhaps he had a supply of dark matter already sourced and waiting to be implanted in the device. Maybe even now he was on Tython, down in the old city, going deeper than anyone had ever been and readying to activate the Hypergate. Any moment now. "If it's even there," she muttered. She was still unsure. In all this, the Hypergate's existence was the one nebulous factor. But whether it existed or not, the danger was just as pressing. "This is Dale," she said, watching the scanner as it tracked his ship until it landed. The red spot became blue as it fell motionless, and Lannery dipped the Peacemaker to the south so that she could approach Randan's Folly over a blazing rift in the planet's surface. She needed as much cover as possible. She also needed a plan. But time was short. Malterra and Sunspot grew closer. Deo was still one step ahead. She would have to make this up as she went along. Lannery crouched behind a rock, looking at the mine and the haphazard collection of buildings around it, and wondered how anyone could live there. The mine head itself was at the base of a slope of shale and tumbled rocks, encased in a rickety steel structure with two giant lifting cranes protruding through the roof. The surrounding buildings were low, built almost entirely from rock, and connected by chains, presumably for navigation between buildings during the terrible storms that swept the area. There were no windows. Three heavily armored land cruisers were parked close against the building's walls, and the wrecks of several more were scattered around the area, slowly corroding into the sterile ground. Further along the low valley were three landing pads for whatever freighters and other craft could be used in such an atmosphere. Dale's ship rested on one of these pads, and Lannery knew now why she had not been able to run him down. His ship was a Death Blaster, and one that had seen action, perhaps even during the Despot War. A great swath of its left flank was scorched black, and areas of the hull had obviously been replaced and repaired, judging by their color and styling differences. It was a mean-looking craft, sister ship to the renowned Deathstalkers, except large enough to carry a payload of bombs, equipment, or passengers. They were even rarer than Deathstalkers now. Many had been destroyed during the Despot War, many more dismantled afterward by the Jedi. And those that survived were usually in the hands of mercenaries, Chicaqua warlords, or at remote criminal settlements out on some of Maurer's moons. From the speeds Dale's ship had attained, there was a good chance that it had been customized. She checked the area one more time from behind the rock pile, then ran at a crouch toward the Death Blaster. She kept to the shadows, knowing that Dale would have left some of his stargazers preparing the ship for a rapid escape. Probing out gently, she sensed two minds, their thoughts untroubled. The stargazers were excited. Their plans were coming to fruition. She wondered what Dale would say if he knew how much they had lowered their guard. The moment begged for action, not diplomacy. And though disabling them would have been her preference, Lannery could not risk even the slightest chance of these two coming around while she was down in the mine. Before she moved, she sought comfort in the Force for what she was about to do. Desperate measures for desperate times, she thought. And she remembered how so many had died in agony on Nox. Close to the ship's still-hot engines, the Iktochi woman didn't know what had hit her as Lannery's sword parted her head from her shoulders and severed the long, distinctive horns. She darted up the ramp into the ship, where the second stargazer stood comically motionless, head cocked at the strange sound of steel cleaving flesh he'd heard from outside. "Don't!" he said, and Lannery stabbed him through the heart. He was dead before he slumped to the deck. She glanced around the ship's hold. Empty, and now deserted but for the dead. She ran back down the ramp and headed for the mine. The blazing air burned her lungs, and she knew she should have donned a protective suit and breathing apparatus. But she did not want her movement and senses impeded in any way, and soon she would be below ground. At the main mine building, she paused and crouched down, peering inside through cracks in the old, dilapidated structure. There was no movement, and she sensed no one inside. She heard an explosion in the distance. Startled, she turned and raised her sword. Kilometers away, beyond a low rise to the north, the sky glowed with the huge, pulsing fires of an active volcano. Clouds of smoke and ash billowed kilometers high, lit from within by wild electrical storms. Deadly lava bombs arced through the air. The ground rumbled as if from fear. Inside the enclosure, she approached the two elevators that provided access into the mine. Both were still, shaft doors open, but only one of the cages had descended. If she activated the other, she would alert anyone below. She looked into the dark, empty elevator shaft. It was a long way to fall. Sheathing her sword, Lannery delved into her utility belt and brought out three short lengths of thin, strong rope. She tied two together and formed a harness beneath her arms and around her wrists. Then she clasped the end of the third length tightly in her left hand, and, without giving herself time to consider the madness of what she was doing, she leaped, swinging the rope around one of the taut elevator cables, catching the other end, bracing her feet against the steel cable and pulling tight. She shook for a moment as she found her balance, and the air was filled with a gentle hum as the cable vibrated from the impact. Starting to slide down, she tested the strength of her boots dragging against the cable, only hoping the strong leather would not be burned through by friction in the descent. That would hurt. She sped up. Darkness whisked by. She probed outward with her force sense and felt the open space about her, the shaft square and braced at regular intervals with heavy steel props. Faster than she'd expected, the bottom rose toward her, and she pulled at the ropes and pressed her feet hard against the cable to slow down. She misjudged slightly and struck the elevator cage's roof hard, driving the wind from her lungs and causing a clanging thud that would have been heard by anyone nearby. But there was no reaction, no shout of alarm. After she'd gathered her breath, Lannery lowered herself down between the elevator car and the shaft's wall. At first glance, the mine reminded her of the tunnels beneath Greenwood Station's central tower. There were occasional flickering lights along the narrow corridor leading in two directions, and the walls and ceiling were roughly formed. But it was hot. Heat simmered from somewhere down below. The floor sizzled her worn boots, and a faint glow seemed to flood into the corridor far away to the left. She sensed something moving rapidly toward her along the corridor. Holding her old practice sword before her, Lannery was struck by the gust of hot air and thrown to the ground. She rolled to one side and tried to catch her breath, but the fearsome wind stole it away. The scorching blast, the result of drastic temperature differentials perhaps, simmered her clothing and stretched her skin. She squeezed her eyes tightly shut. Sunspot was trying to bake her alive. The hot wind growled against the walls and then faded away, and Lannery took a deep breath. She smelled sweat. Opening her eyes, trying to stand, she sensed the heavy rock swinging for her head, gathered all her force talents to deflect the injury, but she was far too late. A brief pain, and then darkness fell. Chapter 16. The Alchemy of Flesh.
A Jedi needs darkness and light, shadow and illumination, because without the two there can be no balance. Veer to Bogan, and Ashlaw feels too constraining, too pure. Edge toward Ashlaw, and Bogan becomes a monstrous myth. A Jedi without balance between both is no Jedi at all. He or she is simply lost.
Master Shao Ma, A Life in Balance, 7537 TYA, Thoyor Arrival. The Bloodspite is a shadow with teeth. It trails long tendrils around her that, though thin and easy to break, constrain her. She plucks and kicks at them, and the smell and taste when they snap reminds her of the grassy plains at Bodhi Temple. Long summer afternoons, evenings of music and talk with her family. The thing's body darts in again and again, carried on feathery wings that make no noise at all as they beat at the dusky air. Lannery sends a clumsy force punch, and the spite reels. Its tendrils splash out and teeth clack at nothing. Its teeth are its hardest point. Wings, tendrils, body are all light and airy, giving it the feel of a fancy or memory more than a living thing. Its teeth give it form. The spite attacks again. Lannery feels warm fluid spatter across her neck, and she's not sure whether it's the spite's sap or her own blood. Her moment of panic abates. She is without weapons, but never without the force. And while this being's strange nature might make it immune to any mental assault, Lannery has studied its Stav Kesh. She clenches her fist, gathers a force punch, and heaves it toward the spite. It is flung back with such speed and power that many of its fine limbs are torn off, drifting to the ground and catching the setting sun. The body drops and squirms for a moment before growing still. Lannery examines her wounds. The bleeding is not too bad. Having no wish to wait for more blood spites, she hurries toward the pyramid. And there is a power here. She is awed by the city and aware of its deep history, but what she starts to feel is something beyond or apart from that. It is nothing physical, no throbbing in the ground, no charge to the air. But still, she is flooded with a feeling of such coiled potential that her teeth grind, her heart thuds. It is the most delicious fear. Nothing will deter her. She follows Dale's trail, the only human prints visible on the wind-driven sand and dust. And when his trail disappears for a time, she continues anyway, instinct guiding her onward. She has entered something of a dream zone. This is Typhon, but she no longer knows when. This is home, but she has never felt so far away. The power she feels below and around her is divorced from the Force, and though she asks that strong protective energy that is always within her, she finds no answers. "I'm being repulsed by this place," she thinks. Sadly, she is not surprised that Dale is drawn here. The ruins are so ancient that most of them are long buried by the effects of time, or worn down by wind and sand, rain and sun. But here and there among these small hills and shallow valleys are the tips of pyramids, the slouch of fallen walls, or the deep hollows of openings into the ground. These dark pits yawn and seem to exhale the strange energy she feels. And it is into one of these pits that Dale's footprints lead. Before she can consider the folly of her actions, Lannery goes down. The small glow rod she always carries gives a gentle but consistent light, but in a way she wishes she could not see. The alienness of this place strikes at her. Everywhere else she has been on Typhon has been created by and for those sentients who inhabit the planet now. Humans and Wookiee, Twi'lek and Cathar, many others. Their appearances might be different, but their basic physiologies are the same. The Cathars are relatively short, and the Wookiees usually taller than most, but there is a similarity to their features that makes the places they live and work comfortable for all. These ruins are different. Lannery drops several levels that she eventually realizes are huge steps, as though built for giants. A passageway she moves along is tall and wide. The very air she breathes, still and stale, old and loaded with the dust of ages, seems suited more to something else. She shivers as if watched, but knows that it is only the depth of history that observes. But she is not the first to come down here. Dale's footprints draw her onward, pressed into the dust. They are far apart and deep, as if he is running, and she wonders how he can find his way down here, and what light illuminates his path. That crushing energy seems to throb through the passageways like a pulse through the veins of a giant sleeping creature. It is a discomforting image that Lannery cannot shake, yet she knows it is foolish. The old city is just that, an old city. Archaeologists have been here, historians. Some have been seen and left again, intrigued but not possessed. Others have spent their lives researching this place. A few have never been seen again, and there are stories of such depths. But she wonders whether any of them have ever felt this terrible, pulsing potential, and what they thought of it.
Dale!
She calls, Dale! Surprising herself. Dale! Her voice Dale! Echoes from walls and ceiling, fading into the distance, yet seeming to persist far longer than she could have believed. Later, descending another giant staircase, she thinks she can still hear her brother's name traveling through the darkness. Or perhaps it is simply a memory. Deeper, She starts to wonder what walked these passageways millennia before, and tries not to. So little is known of the Gree, if indeed this was originally a Gree structure. Legend has it that they possessed amazing arcane technologies that allowed travel among the stars. That they were a nomadic species, exploring the galaxy for unknown ends. There were rumors of Gree sculptures somewhere in the old city, but some believe the expedition that supposedly found them fabricated them. Sometimes Dale's footprints fade in areas where the floor has seemingly been blown free of dust, perhaps by underground storms. Power surges as that incredible energy breaks free, maybe once each year or once in a lifetime. So much is unknown, but Lannery's attention is fixed. Her intention is known. Dale needs saving from himself, and she will strive for this as long as she can. Lannery loses track of time. She thinks perhaps a day has passed since she left the surface and ventured down here. She is worried about finding her way back out, but there are footprints, both hers and Dale's now, and there is the Force. It is a comfort to her, and the only reason she can stay her course. She's hungry and thirsty. Water runs down the walls in places, but she cannot bring herself to touch or drink it. She has no idea where it has come from or what, over many centuries, it has been filtered through. There must be countless places that time has forever hidden from view, and countless things that will never be known. She starts calling after Dale more and more. The echoes of her shouts seem to argue, and sometimes she thinks she can hear choirs of Lannery's imploring her brother to return, to turn around, to come to her and home. Lannery thinks she is hallucinating, but can't be sure. The ruins are so old that nowhere is untouched by time's finger. Sometimes they are ravaged, sometimes merely stroked by a reminder that entropy cannot be denied. She passes along large passageways with smaller tunnels leading off, and sometimes by alcoves in the walls that might once have been doorways, but that have long since been closed off. These smaller tunnels offer tantalizing and terrifying possibilities, but Lannery will not be shaken from her course. This is not an exploration. It is a rescue. There are much larger caverns, almost hallways, with strangely shaped pits in the floor that might once have held water, and upright structures with the remains of metal shapes. Perhaps this is technology, rotted away over time. She feels she is closing in on Dale. A metal bridge spans a deep, dark ravine, from the depths of which flows a warm breath. The bridge groans as she crosses it. The darkness beckons. It smells of dusty bone and wet fur, and Lannery crosses the last third of the bridge at a run. Beyond is another large cavern where ranked levels all around look much like seating areas, and a central dais bears the remains of several upright mechanical objects. Lannery pauses to catch her breath. In the distance, she hears a scream. Lannery was being dragged. Voices sounded, urgent and angry, making no effort to hide. She felt heat on her body as they threw her down. She rolled onto her side, feeling for wounds. But there were only the bumps and bruises she was already familiar with, and a few more besides. She still wore her weapons and wrist unit. They hadn't even bothered disarming her. Either they were clumsy, or they no longer viewed her as a threat. Hit on the head again, she thought. Master Kinnaid would be disgusted. She tried to see away some of the pain, losing it to the Force, and a calm numbness descended.
I'm almost done. I'll let you watch.
Dale! But he was dead, wasn't he? She'd come down here looking for him and found... But, no. That was another place. Another time. That was in the past. Lannery opened her eyes and gathered herself, sitting up, hugging her knees to her chest. The air in the mine shivered with heat. Several humans, growth stunted and dressed in reflective clothing and visored helmets, fussed around some mining equipment. Dale stood close to her, blaster in his hand aimed in her direction, and 5 stargazers accompanied him. They were faceless to her, followers of his madness. It was Dale who held her attention.
"You left me for dead," she croaked.
Her throat felt dry and swollen, her tongue like a rock in her mouth.
"Yes, left you. I can't make that mistake again."
Woozy, weak, Lannery tried to touch his mind. Dale pointed the blaster at her face, his lips pressed tight, whole body tensed. She could force shove him aside, and perhaps she'd be able to get to her feet before the other stargazers shot her. Maybe, somehow, she could distract them all. Perhaps, like Master Tave, she could lose herself in the Force, become unseen by them for long enough to disarm and defeat them. But she thought not.
"So shoot me," she said to her brother.
As she spoke, her mind was deluged with a flood of memories of their childhood, their dear mother and father, and the good times that were all now past. She was sad, but incredibly angry as well.
"You and your Force."
"Enough with the talk, Dale. Just shoot me and get it over with."
"You've come this far," he said, smiling. "Don't you want to see my second greatest moment?"
"Second?"
"The greatest is yet to come."
He nodded past the mining equipment at where the device rested on the ground, exposed now, the stargazers standing at a respectful distance. It was surprisingly plain, a round metal shell, several connecting ports around its circumference. It did not look amazing. The miners were checking display screens and working the machinery, and though it ran with barely a whisper, Lannery wondered whether the deep rumbling she felt was caused by what they did here.
"No," she said. "I'm bored."
"You're going to kill me, so why not now instead of later,
brother?"
She spat the last word, hoping for a reaction. But his gentle smile remained. She was trying to goad him into action, hoping that before he pulled the trigger there would be a moment of hesitation, an instant of regret and doubt of which she could take advantage. But Dale was in charge here. Lannery felt the flow of the Force, and knew that she was just as powerful and rich in it as ever. But her sick, mad brother was still in control.
"There,"
a miner said. The machinery before him vibrated slightly, and then grew still, and a square metal box rose from a hole in the floor of the mine. Lannery had seen this before in Hollows, and knew what it was. A Meryonium cube, bearing one of the most unstable yet desirable elements found in Sunspot's mine. But what of the dark matter? Was everything she had seen, heard, learned wrong?
"In the device," Dale said. "You know what to do."
3 stargazers stepped forward and lifted the cube, moving it toward the device. Lannery thought of force shoving them against it, but she didn't know what effect that might have. They were dealing with arcane, ancient technology, and she remembered her journey down into the old city 9 years before, the power she had sensed there, the fear it had instilled. "I have to stop them," she thought, "but I can't risk triggering the device." Stuck between the two, she felt the gravity of both possibilities tearing at her. "No," she said as the stargazer slid aside a panel. The insertion was simple. The Meryonium glowed softly as they tipped it into Dale's device, and then they closed the panel and stood back.
"So what will it?"
one of the miners asked. He did not finish his question. The device finished it for him. It started to turn. Dale gasped, and Lannery realized with dreadful certainty that he really had very little idea what he was doing. He was following old plans, chasing a childhood dream. He was running blind. She tensed, readying to act whether it meant her death or not. Because this could not happen. There was a soft grinding noise as the device turned on the gravelly ground. Then it rose and hung in midair, spinning faster and faster until it seemed to fade from view, return, fade again. Lannery felt suddenly sick. It was a physiological reaction to something very wrong. Oh, Dale. You don't know what you're... The force itself recoiled. Lannery fell onto all fours and vomited, and she felt a flexing of the force, like the natural reaction of a person wincing away from fire. For a flicker, the force was absent from that mine, and in its place was only the device, still spinning and fading in and out of existence. And then the thing slowed to a halt in midair, exuding such a sense of malignant power and unfathomable energy that Lannery vomited again. Weak, head spinning, she looked up at the others around her. The miners were on the ground, holding their heads. But the stargazers were jubilant, and Dale was the happiest of all. "It worked," he breathed, awed and delighted. "It worked! We've done it! It's ready now! It's made its own dark matter, and it's ready! And oh, Lannery, I so wish you could travel with me!" She wasn't certain whether that was a veiled plea, and she did not try to see. She didn't care. "You've become a madman and a monster, Dale. My only aim is to bring you down." "Then this is the end for you," he said softly. Elation quickly fading, he aimed the blaster at Lannery's chest and pulled the trigger. Lannery runs, drawn by the cries, knowing she should be running from them because they are so terrible. But she has come down into the old city to save her brother, and now she fears she is too late. She finds his clothes close to an underground lake. They are shredded and wet. She sniffs the blood. It smells like family. The surface of the lake shimmers as ripples calm to nothing. Without caring what might hear, Lannery screams her grief at the darkness. She sinks to her knees and gathers the clothes to her chest. And even while Dale's spilled blood is still warm, his sister starts to mourn. Chapter 17. Repulsion.
Immersion in the dark side of the Force can seem stronger, more freeing, more triumphant than existing within balance. But only from the outside. Do not be tempted. Those who are swallowed by the darkness lose not only balance and control, they lose their souls.
Master Shalmar, A Life in Balance, 7541 TYA, though your arrival. At the last moment, she grasped the Force with everything she had and brought it before her. Then there was darkness. In her dreams, she chases Dale through the old city forever. He is always only just ahead of her, a whisper around a corner, a laugh in the next ancient cavern, and on the surface, his shadow is just out of reach behind walls or around the sides of dunes. One step ahead, however fast she runs, however slow she walks. But she has no sense that he is teasing her. There's a repulsion between them, and as she moves toward Dale, he moves away from her. Perhaps that repulsion has always been there, even from when they were children. She remembers many times playing together, but now it also seems to her that those times were shadowed by the knowledge of Dale's growing wanderlust and his resentment of his family, and her childhood self was able to ignore these aspects of him. She sees his child's expression with adult eyes and knows what will come.
"I feel terrible," the voice said. "But you look worse. Can you open your eyes? Open your eyes. Please, Lannery."
Lannery tried, but her eyelids were too heavy, her head throbbing and expanding to squeeze them closed.
"Squeeze my hand if you can hear me."
She tried to squeeze, and a white-hot sun of pain exploded in her chest and across her torso, stabbing into her neck, jaw, and skull. She tried to scream, but taking in a deep breath only ignited the pain even more.
"Okay, lie still and..."
The voice faded, and Lannery felt herself falling. The depths below her were dark and filled with malignancy. They might have been in the gree caverns and halls beneath the surface remnants of the old city, the stinking sewers of Greenwood Station, or the blazing mines on Sunspot. Where she was did not matter. The darkness promised death. She swam in the dark, but had no strength to stop her fall. She was moving. Heat buffeted her from all sides. The stink of burning overrode everything else. An old, deep-set burning, molten rock, and singed eons. "I'm still in the mines," she thought, and she tried to open her eyes. Whatever she was lying on struck something and jarred her, and she screamed at the pain that surged through her veins like acid. She tried using the force to smother some of the agony, but it was only partially successful. Movement ceased, and a shadow appeared above her.
"Lannery?"
She saw Trisana's outline as he bent over her, his leku silhouetted against the soft red glow of their surroundings. "What's happening?" she wanted to ask. "Is the mine on fire? Is Dale destroying everything behind him again? Have they taken the Peacemaker? What are you doing here?" But all that emerged from her mouth was a deep groan.
"I'm getting you out," he said. "Ironholgs is pulling. What did you do to him? He's not like any droid I've ever..."
Senses fading again, Lannery tried her best to hang on. But she knew that she was gravely wounded. She felt hollowed out, and wondered how much of a hole Dale had blown in her with his blaster. Dale, her brother, with his blaster. This time when she fell, the force was there to catch her. And through agony, she had a moment of ecstasy as she felt it surround and flow through her. The roof of the mine was on fire. Tree must have dragged her into a huge open chamber below ground, though she could not remember moving through any on her way down. The high ceiling was a splash of red and orange, yellow and white, swirling so slowly in boiling flame that she could make out shapes and features. Some civilizations worshipped fire, and now she knew why. But if they didn't move soon, they would be consumed.
"Almost at the ship," Tree's voice said. "Lannery, you awake? We're almost at the ship, and for Shaq's sake, I'm going to need you then."
Almost at the ship? She thought. Then she realized what she was seeing, and for a moment the all-encompassing pain was swallowed by a creeping, prickling fear crawling from her mind and across her whole body. They were on Sunspot's surface heading for the Peacemaker, and the planet's sky was ablaze. Given context, the sheer size and scope of the scene above her made more sense. The air itself appeared to have been ignited, and great swaths of flame rolled in random directions, exploding against one another in cataclysmic impacts. Lightning arced across her vision, purple streaks parting into thousands of white-hot forks. Sheets of lightning waved. Even greater explosions boomed deep within the fiery atmosphere, billowing outward in gouts that must have been 10 kilometers in diameter.
"Maltera," Lannery whispered,
and Tree's shadow closed on her, leku twitching frantically.
"What?"
"The other planet. Maltera. Draws close."
"You're telling me."
He stood again and continued pushing. From somewhere she could not see, ironholgs clattered and clicked, and she heard the rapid padding steps of the droid's feet as it helped transport Lannery back to her ship. Whose choice was it to come? She thought. But she knew right away. However much personality she projected onto Ironholgs, it was still just a droid. It would have taken a person to make the decision to venture out in this heat and chaos. Tree had come for her, and she had no idea how long it had been.
"Tree,
not now. Almost there.
Tree!"
She groaned as waves of pain radiated from her chest. But the stretcher stopped again, and he bent down so he could hear her above the lightning and fiery roars.
How long?
Almost half a day, he said. On the scanners, I saw the other ship take off, and when you didn't come back... His Leku shrugged.
Oh, no.
Lannery, you've got a hole in you the size of my fist. I've no idea how you're still alive. So shut up while I get you back to the Peacemaker. And then... He started pushing again, and she felt suddenly bad for him. He had no idea what to do. But she did. She remained silent, floating in a sea of pain, as Tree finally reached the Peacemaker and pushed her inside. As the door hissed shut, Tree struggled to shift her from the makeshift stretcher to her cot. She was hardly any help. She rested her head to one side and examined the stretcher, and she was filled with admiration. It was a door from one of the mine's elevator cages, one side ragged from where it had been removed from its mount, and at one end was fixed one of Ironholg's suspension units. It seemed to be smoking a little, ready to expire. Lannery lifted her hand.
Tree. Here.
He sat next to her on the cot, sweating, exhausted. She remembered how sick he'd been when she'd last seen him. Such a short time ago, but already he looked thinner than she remembered, and older.
Take my hand, she said.
Speaking sent pain lancing through her chest, but some things needed to be said. He did so, breathing heavily.
Thank you.
She squeezed his hand and nodded, grimacing at another wave of agony but never breaking eye contact with him.
And now? You have to trust me.
Tree's expression barely changed as she instructed him which cabinet to open and what to bring out. Even when he saw what he brought out, he seemed almost unmoved. Perhaps he had seen more of what Master Dan Powell could do than Lannery had first suspected.
Now help me sit up, she said. I don't have very long.
In that room long ago with Master Dan Powell, before the tragedy with Dale, and while Lannery was still wide-eyed with wonder and potential, the lessons she learned had felt amazing. Your future lies in the alchemy of flesh, Dan Powell had said. I saw it in you the moment we met, and nothing has dissuaded me from that. It is a talent, for some, that lies on the edges of acceptability. It is a strong, challenging power, and you must be firmly balanced to attempt it. You must not let heavier desires tempt you. The dark side lurks close to what I do here, Lannery, and I am always vigilant. Don't be tempted. Don't be drawn. Maintain your balance. The words had always remained with her. Remembering them now, Lannery did as instructed, but there was too much pain, too much pressure. Her mind wanted to find balance in the Force, but her heart forged onward. Dale would not wait for her to be ready. Every moment she wasted here brought them all closer to tragedy.
You might want to turn away, she told Tree.
But Tree only shook his head and sat in the corner of the cabin, eyes half closed. After she had saved herself, she'd do what she could for him. The experiment was as she had left it. Traveling alone, she had long spells when she could concentrate on perfecting such alchemies, and though she was still young, she knew that her talent was great. Proof of that lay before her now. She lifted the cover, and the flesh throbbed. Blood dribbled from imperfect yet adequate veins. Vestigial limbs waved weakly and without purpose. At one edge, a blind eye opened, pupil milky white. Even if it did see, there was no mind to understand. The iris had her coloring, because it was a part of her. The life that animated this flesh was formed by Lannery and drawn from the Force. Over time, she had molded the single collection of cells, taken from her own arm, a splash of blood and marrow, into this, an object with a form of life that was all her own. Its movement still troubled her, as did its partial familiarity. But where there was no brain, there was no mind, and without a mind, it was meat. That was all. Living, pulsing, replicating meat. She continued to tell herself that, even as she wondered whether it felt pain. The power she sometimes experienced as she molded flesh to her own desires was shocking, but right now she found meaning in her experiments at last. "It's not just alchemy," Dan Powell had told her. "It's not just learning the art for the sake of it. It's practicing to be the artist." Lannery gathered herself, resting her hands on either side of the experiment's small pedestal. Her wound was deep and wide, its edges weeping and its depth burning. But at the moment Dale had tried to kill her, she had gathered herself behind the force, and it had swallowed much of the impact. If she hadn't done that, an instant, an instinctive action, her heart and lungs would have been blasted across the mine's floor. Her brother believed her dead. At least she had given herself a chance. She breathed deeply and welcomed the force flowing through her. Closed her eyes. Shut away the pain that threatened to make her sick, the tiredness that lured her down to sleep, and death. The force grew stronger in her, tingling in her fingertips and toes, her neck, her wounded chest, and she directed it into her experiment. The alchemy came alive within her. It was a burning star with a dark heart. "That I have to watch," she thought, but agony swept through her, distracting her. The power was wonderful. She smiled. The flesh before her started to bubble and boil, and without opening her eyes, she stripped off her tattered robe and undergarments and leaned forward. The smell of burning flesh filled the peacemaker. She heard a pitiful whine from Tree but did not look. If he was afraid, he could cover his eyes. Bogan loomed, and she opened her mind's eye to embrace its darkened surface, and at the same time she felt a warm, wet touch between her breasts. It caressed the angry wound and numbed. Lannery welcomed the contact and sought more, leaning farther forward until she was directly over the pedestal of flesh. My flesh. My experiment. My very own alchemy of self. She sought and found Ashlaw, a bright spark within the force. And experiencing herself in balance, the talents she had been made aware of at Anio Kesh and which she had been practicing for so long, began to flow. Flesh flowed with them. Bogan is in her dreams. She was there before becoming a ranger, but only briefly in the company of others. A visit, an education. And in her memory, Ashlaw was always a constant light that drew her away from darkness. But in these dreams, there is no Ashlaw. She stands on a hillside on Bogan, beside the ruins of stone buildings thousands of years old, looking up at another Bogan staring down. Two moons, both of them dark. No hope of light. Lannery sprang awake and sat up, clutching her hands to her chest. She was on her cot, still naked but with a thin sheet gathered around her waist. Iron holes clacked. Tree sat slumped in the corner, head to one side and eyes barely open.
"The sleeper wakes," he said weakly. And he looked very sick.
Beside her cot on the floor between her and Tree was the experiment. It was withered and dry now, the petrified remnants of something long dead. Even the blood that had dripped onto its base was dark, dry, and flaked, as if it had fallen long ago. She looked down at the wound in her chest and took in a deep, startled breath. Her skin was rough and scarred, and there was a definite depression in her chest. But the blaster hole had vanished. She closed her eyes and breathed deeply, twisting to the left and right, and felt no pain inside. Nothing out of place. Nothing missing.
"You look better," Tree said.
"You look worse. Lannery stood from the cot and quickly snatched up her clothes, pulling them on, then knelt beside Tree, resting one hand against his cheek.
I think whatever poisoned me on Nox has reached somewhere vital, he said. My heart staggers. My breathing light.
His leku were limp and pale, and she had never seen his red skin so wan. I can help you, she said, but then she frowned. That withered thing, dry and old, there's nothing left. Not how I helped myself, but I can use the Force to cleanse your blood, perhaps, to purge you.
No time, Tree said. I'll be fine. Had worse. No time.
And Lannery knew that he was right. There was no time, and perhaps even now they were too late. Dale might not have killed her with the blaster, but he meant to. He wanted me to die. He shot me to kill me. But if he reached the old city and initiated the device, then he might succeed in killing her anyway. Lannery slapped a compartment open and dropped a med pack into Tree's lap. Here, drugs. I'm sorry, Tree. Do what you can for now, and I'll... He waved her away. She rushed into the cockpit and ran her hands across the peacemaker's controls. It felt like coming home. She fired the engines, and then paused as the ship shuddered around them. Thank you, Tree, she said, for coming to rescue me.
Only 'cause I can't fly your ship, he said from behind her.
She smiled, pleased that he was nowhere near the bad man he had once been. She only hoped he had more time to make things even better. The scanners flashed. Warning lights chimed. She switched on comm to send a message to Tython, but the flat screen was a haze of snow and crackles. Nothing manifested, and its level indicator fluctuated rapidly. She could have examined the readings closer, but there was no need. Sometimes instruments gave voice to what was visibly obvious. Outside, the skies and surface of Sunspot were in turmoil. The fiery clouds and lightning she had witnessed as Tree and Ironhulks pulled her from the mine had increased. Now they looked cataclysmic. Fingers of lightning thrashed down all around, making the ground shudder and the air bend. The skies were deep red and violent orange, streaked here and there with white-hot flame that ignited massive, thundering explosions high up. Malterra was close. Gravities fought as each planet exerted influence over the other, and it seemed that both sought dominance. They could retreat underground into the deepest mines, as most of Sunspot's miners did on every such occasion. For 4 days they would live down there, feeling the world around them shaking and sensing the great energies being expended above. And then they would climb to the surface to repair any damage, and the mining would begin again. Dale planned this, Lannery thought. He must have. Once in a Malterran year, a quarter of a Tython year. Such coincidence can't be an accident. But Lannery knew that she had no choice. If she desired, she could consult the ship's computer and calculate the odds of her being able to pilot the ship out through such a storm. But she never liked hearing the odds. Can you make it up here? Strap in? She asked Tree. She heard a groan, and then his shuffling footsteps as he came to join her. He stank. His breathing was ragged.
I'll probably puke again.
Don't worry. Ironhulks, prepare for takeoff. The droid clacked and clicked. Lannery increased power to the engines. The ship felt strong and confident around her, and as she took in a deep breath, she felt the same. I am renewed, she thought. She knew that the sense of power and superiority she felt was wrong. Her alchemies were talents that should be borne lightly. Ashlaw and Bogan be damned. She had a more immediate fight on her hands. Here goes nothing, she said, and the Peacemaker blasted from Sunspot's surface and into cosmic chaos. The most direct route from Sunspot to Tython would have taken them straight through Malterra. Lannery programmed the route 4 times, and each time the ship's computer threw out a different alternative. So in the end, she took manual control, switched on four screens with different scaled space charts, and trusted her instincts. There is no fear. There is power, she thought, and she worked with the Force to see them through. She felt queasy. She convinced herself that it was the result of her healing, as opposed to an unsettling of her balance. But the flesh was strong. The strength. The potential. She could not hold down the excitement she felt at such arcane alchemies.
We should wait, Tree said beside her, weak and scared.
She did not answer. He knew as well as she how much was at stake, and how much of a start Dale had on them. They had to travel as fast as they could. There was no other way. The Peacemaker took a pounding as she curved them up out of Sunspot's atmosphere, but the craft had been built to last. The noise was tremendous, and she could hardly hear her own shout. The straps cut into her shoulders and chest. The windows shimmered with heat on the outside. Her seat creaked in its mounting. Loose panels rattled and shook, and the flight stick vibrated so hard in her hand that soon her fingers and forearm grew numb. She could not let go. She fought the storm through the ship and calmed herself with the Force, and Dale was large in her mind's eye. She remembered his face as he'd pointed the blaster and his eyes as he pulled the trigger, and there was nothing there. Scanners showed that they were almost 15 kilometers above the planet's surface, and she increased the power to break them into space. Once there, she hoped the abuse the ship was undergoing might lessen. But she was wrong. Space itself was being rippled and torn by the forces exerted between the two planets as they rapidly closed on each other. They would pass within 500,000 kilometers of each other, and that sounded like a comfortable distance. But flying between them felt like dropping a feather into the winds of Tulsa's grassy plains. Her instruments went haywire from the magnetic and gravitational chaos dancing between worlds. Ironhulk skittered across the cabin behind her and tipped onto his side, sparks arcing from several slits on his head.
Your droids exploded, Tree said.
Even his voice sounded dismantled, broken into constituent parts by the incredible assault on the ship and everything within it.
How long till the Peacemaker goes, too?
The Peacemaker won't go, Lannery shouted. Your brain will fall from your butt before that happens.
I think it already has, he shouted.
She was pleased to hear humor, because perhaps that meant Tree was feeling better. Maybe the medicines he'd taken had helped. But she could not fool herself. She had cured her own terrible wounds using arcane and dangerous Force alchemy. But Tree was different. The poisons eating at him might be slowed, but to stop them would require expert attention. She tried to communicate with Tython, to warn them, but all comm systems remained down. An hour after the attempt, her own message came back to her, surprising her with its air of desperation. She felt sick, and Tree vomited beside her. At least this time, he turned away from her before letting go.
That's the second time you've done that to my ship, she shouted.
No reply from Tree. She glanced across, and he was sitting with his chin touching his chest. His Leku hung limp and unmoving. She switched on the grav unit, but it was malfunctioning in the storms. Her stomach rose and fell. She pressed back into her seat. Something seemed to have come loose in her chest, and she probed delicately, using the Force to feel out the geography of her wound. It felt fine. Her fix had been good. Perhaps it was simply her held breath. Time moved on, every moment an eternity. The Peacemaker shook and vibrated, and more rattles developed. The ship was being shaken to pieces. Arc lightning struck them three times, the third time such a heavy charge that every seam and hole in the hull, control panel, and structure lit up as if they were being burned apart. Lannery screamed out loud but could not hear, and she quietly prepared herself for death. I'll feel nothing, she thought, but she knew what she would see at the moment of death. The madness on her brother's face. But the ship held together, and they did not die. Die. When they were 1,000,000 kilometers out from Sunspot, Malterra passed its closest point to that planet. Lannery watched the passage on one of her scanner screens and wondered at the immense forces and pressures being exerted there right now. In those deep mines, miners huddled. She had every respect for them and wished them well. At last, as the storms seemed to be getting better instead of worse, she ran a full systems check on the ship. Ironholgs was still out of action, so she had to do it herself. They had taken a battering. Life support was damaged, but would last them to Tython. One of the laser cannons had been fractured. She shut off the pod supplying it in case of leakage. A fuel rod had ruptured, and she jettisoned it into space. But the hull integrity was good, and all vital systems were functioning. The Peacemaker was well enough to get them to Tython, and that was her only aim. She plotted the fastest course that would take them to the old city, and handed control to the ship's computer. As she unbuckled herself and stood to squeeze back into the main cabin, something struck her. Lannery gasped and sank back into the seat. A vision. A blow. A ripple in the Force, far greater than she had ever felt before. A ship, she thought. A battle. Death and chaos. And one among them. Then the vision was gone, leaving barely an echo in its wake. Dale's ship? She thought not. There was no sense of recognition at all. Indeed, a coldness had taken her, and an alienness seemed to haunt the shadows of her mind. Soon, that too was fading. Lannery shook her head. Then she lifted Tree from the co-pilot's seat and carried him to the cot. His eyes opened as she lay him down. Half a day and we'll be entering Tython's atmosphere, she said.
Just blast me into space. I'll feel better that way.
He sat up slowly and squinted at Lannery. How do you feel?
How do I look?
Covered in vomit?
That's how I feel.
Lannery sat next to him, frowning. Everything feels so strange.
Well, you did just heal a hole in your chest. You should be dead.
She thought of her experiment and the life she had coaxed into it. Maybe, she said. I need rest. She leaned back and closed her eyes. Wake me when we're approaching Tython. Without even hearing Tree's response, she fell into a deep, troubled sleep. Her dreams are strange. She is aware that they are dreams, yet they are more chilling than ever before. She constantly tries waking herself, but she does not feel in control. There is a figure. Tall, cloaked, armored, an unmarked helmet hiding its features. In its hand is a weapon the like of which she has never seen before. A sword, but strange, with pure force as its blade. The same dream, again and again. Only hands on her shoulder and a familiar voice bring her up from that vision.
Lannery? Tython. But something's very wrong.
Approaching Tython, the chaos on the planet's surface was evident.
What's that?
Tree asked. Force storm. Lannery had never witnessed one from space, but it looked far more violent and widespread than any she had experienced before. She tried contacting Master Dan Powell again, but though her comm unit was now functioning, no signals could pierce the storm.
He started already, Tree said. Whatever it is your mad brother's trying to do, it's begun.
Maybe, Lannery said. And that was her great fear. If Dale initiated the device, perhaps Tython's first response